Well, hi there, folks. Welcome along to this afternoon's session, Keeping the DBA Out of the Database. Before we get started, what I'm going to do, because I know everyone's feeling a little bit tired at the end of the week, I'm sure some people have still got a little bit of a hangover and still feeling sore and sorry for themselves, so I'm just going to get everybody up in the room. We're just going to get a little bit of blood circulating around the body. Just going to have a little bit of a stretch. So guys, just get everyone to stand up. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get everyone to get pop their hands up in the air. And then just put one arm behind. Let's put the other one behind. And then at the back, now let's shake it all out. Doesn't that feel fantastic? But before you guys sit down, I just want you to turn around and just point fingers at everybody that's sitting down at the moment and couldn't be bothered standing up. So guys, I'll get you to sit down. So guys, I'm actually really surprised about the number of people that we've actually gotten this afternoon's session. I'd heard a little rumour before by a colleague of mine, Greg Lowe, in this morning's session. For those that weren't curled up in bed like me still, apparently I was supposed to have a slab of beer here that I was going to give away to everyone that turned up to this afternoon's session. So unfortunately I don't have a slab of beer, but I do have something a little bit special for you guys at the end, just in case anyway. So look, from talking to people whilst on the stand and throughout TechEd, there's been a lot of interest about this particular topic, keeping the DBA out of the database. We've got two sides of the fence typically. We've got our DBAs that are traditional DBAs. Look, I need to go and rule the world. I need full control over my entire environment. I need access. There's no way you're going to take anything away from me. But then you've got the developers on the other side and also management, and they're going, well, I don't have full access to the environment. I'm able to do my job. Why is it that you need that? And one of the things I enjoy about being a consultant is the opportunity to work with various different organizations around the world. And sometimes while working with them, we come across problems that we really haven't thought deeply about. And this is one of these particular problems. And this has come from some work we've recently done with a large financial services organization. We're very proud to say that we're actually awarded the Microsoft Data Management Partner of the Year for 2011 based on this particular solution. So really today I want to take you on a journey of discovery and show you how you can start to keep the DBA directly out of the database. So folks, for those that don't know me, my name's Peter Ward, and I'm the Chief Techular Architect for Wardy IT Solutions. I'm a SQL Server MVP. I'm also a Microsoft Virtual Technical Specialist as well, and I'm proud to say I was actually awarded the VTSP of the Year from Microsoft as well. So look, I also run the Queensland SQL Server User Group, and look, I'm just an all-round nice guy. Yeah. So folks, we're going to really sort of just take you on a bit of a journey, because really, today's topic could be very, very dry. It could be just based on security, ramming home about the whole SA thing and we don't need to give people DBO rights. But I want to start with the basics because I want to get everybody on a level playing field. Because often we overlook these basics as DBAs and people that are working with SQL Server. We forget them. So we're going to introduce some of those concepts around best practices for security. Once we've introduced the concept around best practices for security, we're going to look at how we can actually start to remove the elevated privileges that we have in SQL Server today, but enable us to go and do that job. And thirdly, what we're going to do is we're then going to dive deeply into what's called the separation of duties framework. Now, the separation of duties framework is a CodePlex project that we've contributed to and helped to extend in order to really simplify the whole process of keeping that DBA directly out of the database. So allowing them to do their job, but not giving them full control over the world. But what I want to do before we get started is I want to just show you a shocking statistic. But before I show you that, I just want you to just take a think about your own databases that you've got in your own organizations, about some of the data that you might be storing in there. I'll just give you guys a couple of seconds just to think about that. Now, the statistic that I'm going to show you is absolutely shocking because really 92% of databases, according to a Gartner study in 2010, have had some form of unauthorized access within the last 12 months. So that unauthorized access might be malicious, where somebody's going in there and actually harvesting all of the data and maybe selling that to someone external to the organization, or maybe using it for their own evil or profit, whatever they might be doing with it. But the other thing is there's also non-malicious, but also unauthorized access. If I've got a table called remuneration, what do you think I'm storing in the remuneration table? Salary, so I know what everyone else is getting paid in the organisation. So I can imagine at pay review time as a DBA, that would be a very powerful tool to have because you know what all the other DBAs are actually being paid. So it's going to make that negotiation process a little bit easier. When your boss says, no, no, we can't afford to give you a pay rise, you can go, well, how come Joe sitting in the seat next to me is getting paid $20,000 more than me, and be armed with that. But this is the type of unauthorized access that we're seeing in organizations day in, day out. Because the thing that we need to think about is the typical person that we think that's going to actually rob us is the guy that's got a gun and a balaclava on it. We're thinking about the external threats to our organisation, and typically physical threats externally. And I think a great example of that, we were doing work recently for a bank, so the bank will actually remain nameless, but their head office there is actually above one of their branches. So in order to go and get to the data centre, which is stored on the bottom floor, you actually need to go through the main part of the bank. And I found it very interesting because as I walked through the bank, there's actually an armed guard standing at the front door. As I walked through the bank, I could go and see all of the security cameras watching every movement as I walked through that bank. I then saw that they had time delay locks on all of the safes. They then had signs about ink bombs on all of the cash. And finally, when I got close to the tellers, you could see that they had the bandit screens that would come up in order to go and protect the bank tellers inside of the organisation. But the problem is, just think about it. How often are there robberies at a bank these days? Very rarely. People are looking to go and target softer targets. There's certainly a lot of robbery that still goes on, especially being down the Gold Coast, obviously. But those robberies are typically things like the convenience stores, service stations. But really, what we need to start to think about it is it's not the external threat that we need to worry about. It's this guy sitting on the screen here at the moment. We trust him. We've interviewed him. We've employed him. Yes, he's under an NDA probably and things like that, but we've given him a swipe card. He can go and walk around the building and do exactly whatever he wants. He's also got a login directly onto our network. He's not having to force anything from the perimeter in order to get in. They've got carte blanche access often to many of the sensitive pieces of information that we have throughout the organisation. And I say this because I've got an interesting story from a customer over in Pacific Island. So we were recently brought in there to actually help assist with a fraud case. So what had actually happened is the DBA, just like this gentleman on the screen here, had full access to the entire database. So this was their core banking platform that it had. So this DBA over time had just been looking at his bank balance. And all of a sudden he decided one day, I might just go and add a zero to my bank balance. That's what we all do as DBAs, isn't it? We just get in there, go and find our data, and just go and modify it. It might be bank balance, it might be that we've got a fine, it might, whatever it is, we've got the ability to go and do that. Now, this went on for quite a period of time, and he got pretty cocky about this, because he thought, I've added one zero, I haven't been caught. What if I add two zeros? Still not caught? Three zeros? All of a sudden, it wasn't until his bank balance was greater than the GDP of this country that all of a sudden they detected that, hey, there's a real issue here. And that's what this whole concept of keeping the DBA out of the database is designed to do. Because in our organisations today, we're governed by a number of different regulatory compliance. For example, if you deal with credit card processing, you've got what's called PCI compliance, and an external auditor will actually come and vet that process. It might be that you're actually a company that's actually listed on the American Stock Exchange, or maybe your parent company is listed on the American Stock Exchange. So all of a sudden you're governed by Sarbanes-Oxley. We've got anti-money laundering policies, we've got HIPAA, we've got a number of three-letter acronyms that we need to start to think about how do we achieve that regulatory compliance. And typically we can't achieve regulatory compliance unless we remove the DBA directly out of the database. So let's go back to first principles here, because before we talk about security, we need to talk about the two components of SQL Server that make up security, and that's principles and securables. And there's a big difference between both of those, because principles are objects that we can grant access to. And typically when we think about granting access, we think about our login. So just think about SQL Management Studio. We connect to the server. We've got the security node. We've got logins there. But beneath that logins, we've also got things called certificates as well. So it doesn't have to be a physical login that we're giving access. It also can be a certificate as well. But then the next level down is the securable. Now, the securable is the object that we're wanting to protect. So that's the data asset that we're trying to protect. And I call it a data asset because I don't call it a table or I don't call it a view, because in our organisations, data is the second most important asset that we have. People is the first, data is the second. Data is what gives an organization strategic leverage over everybody else that their other competitors. So that's why we want to start to treat data as an asset and protect it the same way that we would the gold bullion or the cash that we've got sitting behind the bank teller screen, because data is actually more valuable. Because if you think about a bank in that scenario, if a robber comes in and robs a bank and takes all of the money, the bank's still going to survive. If the robber comes in though and takes all of the data, that bank probably isn't going to survive. So that's why we need to start to think about data as an asset that we need to go and protect. But I want to do a quick straw poll before we go too much further. And this is around the whole concept of sysadmin. Now, I want a quick show of hands. I just want you to, before we show hands, just take a couple of seconds just to read what we've got on the screen here at the moment. So the question is are permissions checked if a login is a member of the sysadmin server role? Quick show of hands. Who thinks permissions are checked if somebody's a member of sysadmin? Yeah, a couple of people? Yeah, so what actually happens is there's actually an internal permission check algorithm. If I go and pop somebody into a member of the sysadmin server role, I've gone and made them God. They've got full control over that SQL Server instance, and there is nothing that I can do to stop them. I can't go and, you know, deny access on a table. I can't stop them executing a stored procedure. As soon as I put them a member of sysadmin, that's it. Nothing is further checked. They control that box. Is that something that we really want our DBAs to be able to do, have full control over the entire server? Yes, I want them to be able to run a SQL agent job. Yes, I want them to be able to back up the database. But do I really want them to have access to the credit card detail table? Probably not. And this is what we need to start to think about, is sysadmin is an elevated role that we want to make sure that we limit the membership of. And those members that are in that role, we want to make sure that we audit and go through a governance process around that. So the sysadmin server role, a couple of best practices that we want to do is, let's not use it for everyday tasks. Guys, do you log into your local workstations and fire up Outlook using a domain administrator account? Well, why should you do the same thing with your SQL Server instances? You want to go through a formal governance process. So the same way that if you go and try and run something inside of Vista and above, you go and get what's called UAC. So UAC pops up because you're trying to go and perform an escalated process. If you do that on Server 2008, you actually need to go and type some credentials in. Now, the reason that that was introduced, UAC and that whole compliance, is really to go and stop having an escalator account and accidentally running a virus or doing something else that's going to go and infect the entire environment. We want to start to think the same way with sysadmin. Only use the sysadmin account when we need to, and audit who's a member of that particular role. Because we really need to start to think about, does somebody really need sysadmin? Because often what we might find is that we've got what's called the control server permissions, which may be sufficient. So what we want to do is implement control server. Because what control server allows us to do is it allows us to give somebody almost sysadmin rights, but then start to protect what they can and can't do after that. Because remembering that sysadmin, we don't go and check permissions any further once they've logged on. With the control server rights, what it allows us to do is it allows us, yep, that person connect, they've got elevated privileges, but I can then block them from accessing a particular securable. Now, that securable might be an entire database, or it might be an individual data asset, such as a table, that I want to go and protect against. So rather than using sysadmin, we want to go and start to put people in the member of the control server rights, because that gives them the limited permissions that we're trying to achieve. So what you'll see on the screen at the moment is an example of how we would go about using control server. So you'll see that what we do is we go and grant control to the particular role. That can be a SQL login, or it could also be a group or an individual Windows account there. So we grant control server, but what you'll see is that we then go and deny alter to that any login. So what that means is we then don't allow that person to modify their own login. They can't, you know, then escalate their permissions to sysadmin. And what you'll see there is we then go and deny control on that particular table. So in the AdventureWorks database, we've got a table called Employee Pay History, which we're then able to block. So this person is now able to log in with very, very high level of rights across the server. They can run DBC this, DBCC do that, whatever it is that they need to do, but we're then able to then block them out of that particular table. So start to think about how you can go and implement control server as opposed to having somebody just the default member of the sysadmin server role. So, folks, I'm going to ask for a little bit of honesty in the room here. Basically, it's a bit like sort of showing the Grundy undies. Who here is using SA to connect to their servers? Logs in as SA. Or has applications that use SA with a blank password, probably. Yeah. We need to seriously start to think about SA. And the reason I say is because it's a known attack vector. What you'll see actually on the bottom of the slide here is actually came out of a customer's SQL Server logs recently where we're engaged because they're actually attacked. Basically, every SQL Server instance around the world has an SA account. I now know 50% of the access in order to get in that particular box. So what you'll often find is that you're being brute forced continually. And this is very important if you're exposing your SQL Server instances publicly inside of a DMZ. So you may actually have that port directly open for reasons that you're communicating or replicating to a remote site. So straight away I've got that port, I can then go and port scan that and identify that that port is then listening there, and I can then start to brute force it. With today's computing power, I start with SA and I start with a blank password. I then try A, AB, ABC, ABCDE, and in order to brute force, we can do that very, very quickly. So we want to stop using SA. But more importantly, we also want to think about maybe even renaming that account so we've removed that attack vector totally. So still having the SA account, but call it something else. Call it My SA, whatever it is that you need to do in order to go and protect directly against that. Because what we have here is a really high privileged account that really is a known attack vector. Every single bad guy in the world knows that SQL Server's got SA. If something's listening on port 1433, hey, we've got SQL here, let's go to town and have a bit of fun. So what we want to do is we want to go and disable and rename that account. So in order to do that, we simply go and alter login. Now be aware that since SQL 2008, that's been disabled by default. So when you install SQL Server, the SA account is actually disabled. You need to make a conscious decision in order to go and enable that particular account. But to provide an extra level of security, we can also then go and alter that login and change the name. So in this case, I've called it SQL SA rather than SA. So while we're on the topic of roles, if you think about the way that SQL security works, it's really a top-down level approach. So we've got three levels of security. Do I have access to the server? Yes or no. If I don't have access to the server, then I can't proceed any further. Do I have access to the individual database? Yes or no. Do I have access to the schema? And then do I have access to the individual object? So the same way that sysadmin at the server level, we don't go and check the permission algorithm any further, we do the same thing with the DB owner role as well. Because if I'm a member of the DBO, what you'll find is that it's an automatic member and sysadmin maps directly to DBO. So by default, we're now getting elevated permissions that we may not necessarily need in that particular database. So what we can do is we can restrict the DBO owner. So once again, you'll see that we're doing a create user here for that particular login. We're then adding the role member, and then we're denying that particular role as well. Now, what we're saying here is it's actually a little bit of work. So if you think about the way that we install SQL Server today, in a lot of organizations, it's nothing more than getting the DVD or the ISO, dropping it in, and clicking next, 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 and hey, presto, we've got a brand new SQL Server instance that's installed. We need to start to think about what are the data classifications of all of our data. What is it that we need to protect? Is it insensitive? Is it commercial in confidence? Is it secret? Is it highly protected? What is the data classification for our data? Because that really dictates how much effort that we need to then go and then start spending on that data in order to then go and protect it. Now, while I was putting this presentation together, I actually came across this quote. It's actually nobody I couldn't actually reference back to anybody, but I think it's actually a really good example of what security is. Is security is assigning permissions as needed and denying permissions where risk is being assessed. And the key thing is that risk. What is the risk to my organization if somebody has access to this data or it's made publicly available? Now, if you think about what's happening over in California at the moment with a lot of the data custodianship laws, there's effectively a $10,000 fine for every single individual's record that's potentially released. So if you're an organization that's collecting information about customers, all of a sudden somebody's able to download that information and make that available, it's a $10,000 fine for each individual customer. If you've got hundreds or thousands of customers, you can imagine that the bill for that particular data breach is going to be extreme and probably put the organisation directly out of business as a result of that. So we need to start to think about what's the risk of having this data being made available external to the organisation. So when we talk about permissions in SQL Server, we've got a lot of granularity, and we can apply this granularity in order to then go and address this risk. We've got over 120 different granular permissions that we can go and apply across the board inside of SQL Server. So these are permissions at different levels. We looked at the controlled server. We briefly had a look at alter any on the login and denying that. But these are the different permissions that somebody has. So we need to start to think about what that matrix and what that map for security really starts to look at, because we want to make sure that we don't go and use the fixed server roles. Because who can tell me what the fixed server roles in SQL Server are? So we've got sysadmin, yep, security admin, server admin, yep, backup operator, yep. Yeah, so data readers at the database level, so you've got database level permissions. So we've got basically a handful of. But do you really think that that handful of server roles is going to cover every scenario in your organisation? If I want somebody to be able to go and change the passwords for SQL Server, what role would you put them in today? Security admin? Typically, that's what you would start to think about, is putting them in security admin. But you need to start to think is what is the flow-on effect of adding somebody into that particular role, because it also grants the person not only the ability to change a password, but create a brand new login. Is that something that I want that same person to do that can change the password? Probably not. So that's why we need to start to think about taking advantage of the level of granularity that we have inside of SQL Server today. So don't just use the fixed server roles that we've got. Think about what the roles are, because we can now go and create our own customised roles in Denali moving forward at the server level. Today, we can't go and create our own custom server roles. We can create our own custom database roles, but look forward to what's going to come in Denali with the ability to do that directly at the server level. But we'll show you what you can do today by using the separation of duties framework. So let's dive into a demo. And this demo shows that example that we spoke about there. I've got a help desk user in my organisation and I want to give them the ability to go and change a password. I'm just going to switch across to the demo machine. Okay. So what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to go and create a login. So I'm going to, I've got a new person that's starting a new role, the help desk role. So I'm going to create a login called help desk with the super secret password there. What I'm then going to do is I'm going to add them into the security admin fixed server role. So in order to do that, I use the SP add server role and select the login. Okay. So what I'm now going to do is I'm going to log in as our help desk user here. So you said I go and connect to the database engine, help desk, put my super secret password in. And what you'll see is that when I connect, that I try to access AdventureWorks, and I get access is denied. This is what we want. We want to protect. We want to make sure that this person can't get into our databases, but we want to have them the ability to go and simply change a password. So what you'll see now is I'm just going to change my connection here. So I just change my connection. I'm going to log in as help desk here. Okay. So I'm now logged in as the help desk. You'll see that as the help desk user, because I'm a member of the security admin fixed server role, I can run create login and I can go and create a login called bad help desk. But what I want you to see is if I come across here and go into security and find my own login, so help desk, what you'll see is from a server role, I can't go and add myself to sysadmin. So look, I can't go and escalate myself up to sysadmin. So look, I've been doing a little bit of a reading, so I'm a help desk guy and I've, found SQL Server Central, or maybe I've gone and found whatever my favourite forum is, and I've done a little bit of research around this whole SQL Server security thing. And look, I've just decided that, look, I didn't get a pay rise last week or whatever the case might be. I'm really, really angry with my company and I want to start to do something malicious. So I've gone and armed myself with all of this knowledge that I now have about SQL Server, and I've gone and found that because I'm a member of the security admin fixed server role, I can all of a sudden go and do a create login. So I'm going to go and create a login called bad help desk. What you'll see is I can then go and run grant control server. It's a bad help desk. So what I've done there is I've added myself into that particular level of permissions. I'm now going to log in as the bad help desk person. So connect to bad help desk. And what you'll see is I can go to databases. Now I can get into AdventureWorks. I can go into tables. All of a sudden I can go and right-click there. And look, I'm just going to randomly delete an individual table. So I've now got the ability to do that. So I've gone and taken somebody that I thought I wasn't giving a set of high-level privileges to and shown how that person can then go and escalate their rights very, very easily. And that's why we need to start to think about not just using the fixed server roles, but creating more granular permissions that we can then go and use. So one of the things that we need to start to think about is using this function called built-in permissions. So what built-in permissions allows us to do is we obviously need to be at a high-level privileged account in order to use that. So I'm just going to come back in as sysadmin. It allows us to then go and see what the permissions are based on control server. So that was what we granted in the bad help desk example. So you'll see everything that that person can then go and do. So we need to start to think about whenever we go and create a login, running that function in order to determine and think to ourselves, do I really want that person to be able to create a brand new login? Do I really want that person to be able to elevate that login? So these are the things that we need to think about as DBAs inside of our organisation. So what I'm now going to do is I'm going to do what we should do with this particular login. So rather than adding them into security admin, we can simply go and give them what's called the alter any login. So the alter any login allows them to then go and modify existing logins, but not go and create new logins. So let's go and do that, remove that person. So what you'll see here is I can now go and reset if I change my connection to help desk user. So you'll see that I can alter that login, so I can go and set the password. It used to be super secret, now I'm going to change it to strong password, no problems at all. But what you'll see is if I try to grant control server to that login, you'll see that I don't then have permission. So I can change somebody's password, but I can't then go and escalate them. So that's really the level of rights that I wanted to give them. So that's why you need to think about where we're adding that particular person to. So the same way you wouldn't add somebody to sysadmin. So one of the things that we've now got in the ability with our logins is to actually map our SQL logins directly to our password policies inside of Windows. So that means that that password needs to go and get changed on first login. So if I go and log in as the log to the help desk, the fact that they then need to go and change that. So typically it's going to be another user that's then going to use that password then. So the fact is they'll go and change that straight away. Yeah, there certainly is. We're actually about to cover that. So that's a great question. So the question is this really secure? Because I'm still allowing somebody to go and change somebody else's password and then going and logging in as that particular person then. So, you know, I've got an account called Fred. My name's Peter. I go and change Fred's password and I then go and log in under that particular person. So look, that person hopefully doesn't have any escalated rights. If they do, what we would do is we would use an auditing mechanism to actually go and detect that and then trigger when somebody's gone and done that and keep our audit log. Because at the end of the day, we still need to give people in our organisation some form and some level of trust. So the same way that, you know, the help desk can go and reset your Windows password and then they can all of a sudden log in into your own machine, get into your outbox and things like that. So hence the reason that we can't, it's not just security, it's security in depth. We need a number of different layers in order to protect our data assets. So the great question, I think that was fantastic. So let's dive back into our deck. And this is exactly where we're going to move on to is auditing. Because if you think about where we've come from with auditing, in previous earlier versions before SQL 2008, the only real way to audit was by implementing what was known as C2 auditing, or common criteria auditing. What that was implemented was around a Department of Defense requirement that came out of the US that everything needs to be audited. One of the problems for a lot of organizations is if you couldn't actually audit, SQL Server would stop. So basically it means that you can never have an unaudited event. But the problem with that is it wasn't granular on the level of auditing. It would audit everything. Do I need to really audit all of the hundreds of databases that I may have on a SQL instance? Or is it just the one protected database that I need to? Or it might be just one individual table. Now, recently working with a customer that had regulatory compliance around implementing C2 security. So they had a ginormous database. This database was 4 gig in size. It was huge. But really, 4 gig is tiny. But in 30 days, how much auditing information do you think was generated by this 4 gig database? Yeah, 6.2 terabytes of audit information was generated. So how do you start to manage that amount of auditing information? And that's why in SQL 2008, they introduced the server and database auditing features. The server and database auditing features allow us to have very granular auditing. It allows us to protect an individual table, even down to the level of when an individual login logs in. So in the scenario that I described before, where that particular DBA was adding zeros, we could implement this auditing to only audit when that particular event occurred. So when this DBA accessed this particular table and performed an update statement, we could capture that and then wrap whatever appropriate mechanism around that. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive into a demo and have a look at how we can go about using auditing in order to start to protect ourselves against insider threats. And this really starts to address, well, okay, if somebody can go and change that password, well, from a perspective, we can then go and see when that has actually happened and then do something and respond accordingly around that. So what you'll see here is I'm going to go and create an audit. Now, creating an audit is very much like creating a SQL Server profiler trace today. And that's where I go and select where it is that I want to go and log that information to, how much data do I want to keep, and what's the frequency that I then want to go and roll this particular audit over. So you'll see that what I'm doing here is I'm creating my audit admin. So I'm just an audit called admin audit. I'm going to log it to the application log. Now, there's three locations that I can go and log an audit to. I can log it directly to the Windows event log, so the application log. I can log it to the Windows security log, but I need escalated permissions on the SQL account in order to do that. So there's two particular permissions at an AD level that I need. Or alternatively, I can log it directly out to the file system. And you might be saying, well, that doesn't sound very secure, logging out to the file system. So typically what you would do is that file system would be on a separate server, and that file system would then only have access for the SQL Server service account. So nothing else has access to it, to that particular account. So that's how you'd go and protect that when you're storing on the file system. In this case, for simplicity's sake, what I'm doing is I'm logging it to the application log. You'll see I've got what's called a queue delay here. Now, the queue delay, because effectively our audit is basically like a giant funnel that we're throwing all of this data directly into. And this is 1 second or 1,000 milliseconds for the time that that information is hardened. We can set that to zero, but by setting that to zero, it means that the transaction is not considered to be complete until the auditing has been successfully completed as well. So you need to then once again go through this risk assessment process of how do I go about protecting my data. And you'll see that on failure here, I continue. So what that means is if I can no longer write the audit log because maybe my drive's filled up for some reason or the network where it was being written to has gone offline, SQL Server will stop. In this case, I've actually got it set to continue, which means that even if I can't write the audit information, SQL will then continue. So let's go and create this audit. So what you'll see is that when I go and create this audit, it's actually going and being created underneath the security inside of Management Studio. So you'll see here if I now go and collect in Management Studio, Under security, we'll just collapse our logins. You'll see that we've got audits. Let's go and refresh that, and you'll see there's my audit. Now, the audit is disabled by default, but in creating this audit, I need to add what's called an audit specification, because the audit specification allows me to have that fine-grained, granular control about exactly what it is that I want to audit. So in this particular thing, in this particular example, what you'll see is, for example, when I go and change the principal, when I change permissions, when I change role memberships, I'm going to audit that information. So let's go and create that audit specification. Now that I've created that audit specification, I'm going to turn my audit on. So in order to do that the same way that you alter an index, it's that same nomenclature, alter, turn on. So alter that server audit, just turn it on. So now what I'm going to do now that I've altered it, I'm going to create an event that would then trigger an audit. So I'm here, what I'm doing is I'm changing the server role, I'm taking my bad help desk and I'm escalating them up to sysadmin. Okay, so we've changed that role. If I now go and open up Event Viewer, and I now go and have a look at my local application log, what you'll see is that we've gone and triggered that event that we can then capture. So Windows log, application logs. Okay, so there you'll see that we've gone and captured that audit event just here. We can scroll down, we can go and see who did it, what were they logged in as, and all the information about that particular event. So we've now gone and captured that audit information and can then respond accordingly when that's happened, because we can then go and say, hey, how come Fred Bloggs was going and escalating that permission or changing that password when there was no help desk ticket assigned in order to go and do that? So with every solution around security, we also need to make sure that we maintain audit and audit trails so we can then see what's exactly happening from a security perspective. So the same way that you would have change logs, in order for somebody to be escalated into the sysadmin group, typically what it should need in an organisation is that it actually gets sign-off from basically the security team in order to do that. So we have a separate team that then signs that off, gives that permission for somebody to be added to that role. The auditor then all of a sudden raises a red flag and say, hey, there's a problem. Somebody's gone and changed the role membership into sysadmin. So the next thing that we want to start to talk about is we want to start to talk about the whole concept of separation of duties. Now, separation of duties is something that's used in a lot of organisations in a number of different processes. So I think the best example of this is writing a check. So you're going to have somebody that writes the check, and then you're going to have somebody that actually puts the signature in order to then go and authorise that particular check. So you'll have maybe your accounts team that's doing it, and then you maybe have an executive that then needs to go and sign that check. So what that's doing is protecting fraudulent activity happening because it's only certain people. So you'll find that, you know, the executive can't write the check, but they can sign it. The other person can't sign the check, but they can write the check. So we've got a two-stage process that we go through in order to protect fraudulent behaviour, but also implement additional security in the organisation. And separation of duties is also something that we can implement inside of SQL Server. So by implementing separation of duties, we need to start to remove people from having the ability to have elevated permissions. So elevated permissions, we need to think about what is it that our DBAs really need to start access to. So really, at a minimum, as we said earlier, our DBAs should not be a member of sysadmin. But really, there are sometimes certain tasks that we do need to go and escalate up where you would need that sysadmin. And this is where we have the whole concept of what's called a break glass role. So that break glass role is in an emergency situation or when I need to make a particular change, I have an Active Directory group. That Active Directory group is mapped directly into the sysadmins inside of SQL Server. By default, the only people that are members of that group is nobody. Okay, so there's nobody actually a member of that particular group. But in order to then go and elevate my permissions, we go through that process that we spoke about before. We talk to our security team. We go through the CAB process, the change advisory board, in order to then have that formally signed off. That person is temporarily escalated to those permissions that they need. Once that's completed, we then go and remove them back out. But the problem with that, though, is I want to actually remove everything from a DBA. I want to take away everything. I want them basically to be able to do nothing but back up my database, run re-index scripts, whatever it might be. I don't want them to have access to a table or any piece of data directly inside of my database. So what I want to do is I want to allow them to actually manage the container. I don't want them to have access with what's sitting inside of the container. And that's something that's actually fairly hard to achieve without actually starting to then pull back the layers of elevated privileges. And there's two ways that we can go about doing that. And the two ways that we can go about removing the concept of escalated permissions is using what's called execute as. So allowing somebody then execute under the context of a different account. So they logged in as foo, but they can actually run something as bar, so a different account. Or alternatively, going and using a concept that's called sign modules, so sign security modules. And that's where we actually provide a certificate for this particular process and then allow that to be executed. So what we're talking about here is we're talking about rather than somebody running backup database to disk equals blah or right-click inside of Management Studio, what we're doing is we're going to create a custom wrapper. We're going to create a custom wrapper around that process that enables them to go and perform their job, but only at that particular level. So rather than being a member of backup operator, they now go and run this custom procedure that I've written. Because one of the reasons we don't want to use execute as, and one of the issues that we have around that, is the whole audit trail. So we've spoken about auditability. I want to know who executed exactly that. Was it Peter? Was it Bill? Who was it? When we use execute as, the execution context is not necessarily the caller of that particular stored procedure. So execute as allows us to then run something, but then it's called as someone else. And the best way to do that is have a look at SQL Profiler and really have a look at an example of what goes on under the covers when we go and use execute as. Because what we want to make sure is that we're always executing under the context of a particular user, and we can guarantee that user is the person that's called that. So what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to quickly flick back. So let's go and open up Profiler here. What I've done is I've gone and created a Profiler template, so one that I've prepared earlier, called TechHead, that captures the information that I want to capture. So it's going to capture the execution of the stored procedure, but it's also then going to capture the code inside of the procedure. So what I'm going to do is file, new trace, connect to my local SQL instance. So I'm going to go and choose my template. So TechEd 2011 and run that. Okay. Right. So what I'm now going to do is I'm just going to flick across to my next demo. So what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to go and create a database called DBA Admin. So let's just go and create that database. So create database. Inside of that database, I'm then going to go and create our stored procedure. So this stored procedure, very, very basic example, we're just going to call it execute as, and you'll see it's going to execute as the owner and really basic command here, select one. So that's all we're doing in that particular stored procedure. Create schema as well, let's do that. Create that proc again. What I'm then going to do is I'm going to get grant execute on that stored procedure to our help desk role. Now that's going to fail. Why is that going to fail? Yeah, I need to go and map that particular user into that database. So what I'm going to do is come back inside of my security tab, find my help desk login, and I'm then going to simply just map that. So you'll see that I then go to my user mappings. You'll see that in DB admin I then just leave them a member of public. Okay, so I'm going to grant them execute now. Okay, so we've granted execute on that. So what I'm now going to do is I'm going to log in as my help desk user. So change my connection back to help desk again. Yeah, thanks for calling it out and just laughing. So now let's go and execute that. But what we want to have a look is we want to then look at what happens inside a profiler then. So we've gone and executed that. Let's come across over in SQL Profiler and stop. So what you'll see here is that when I went and executed that particular stored procedure, you'll see that the execution context of that was help desk. However, the command, the actual select statement, wasn't help desk, was Peter Ward. It was my individual login. So from an auditability point of view, is that going to stand up in court? Of course not. I'm going to say, well, it wasn't me that ran that. I didn't run that select statement. It was Peter Ward. Go and put him on the trial. I'm not on trial. So we need to think about that execution context, because from an auditability point of view, we're actually executing that command under the context of somebody different to who it was that actually ran that stored procedure in the first place. So that's why we want to not use execute as in order to do that, although it certainly achieves that. And question down the back. Yeah, it will, yeah. So the question was, if we're using a proxy account, what's going to happen? It's also then going to do that. So we can see the account that called the stored procedure, but the command that was executed in the stored procedure is executed against that different context. Yeah, so the problem though, and we've been in this situation before, so the question was, is will we still get that from an audit trail perspective? What you need to be able to do is basically make it very, very clear about who's actually executed, because somebody could then clearly argue that, hey, it actually wasn't me that did that. So although we've got that audit trail, what we're really trying to say is, from an execution context, we need to think about who it is that we then have in that particular role. So let's just go and stop our trace. And we'll now flick back to our deck, because what we're going to have a look at is the whole concept of separation of duties. And the way that we use separation of duties is with what's actually called a code sign module. So what the code sign module does is it provides us a secure mechanism in order to then create an execution container that somebody can use that has limited rights. And this is the scenario that we spoke about before, is because a module can be a function, can be a trigger, it can be a stored procedure, and it can be DBCC commands as well. So all of our consistency checks, our backup databases, and those style of processes. Because what we do is we create a container that allows somebody to execute them, but we can also, from that container, limit what parameters they're able to use. Because they don't go and call the underlying existing procedure, they call this brand new procedure. So what we do is we create what's called a signed module. It's reliant on a certificate, so we create a certificate that then goes and signs this particular procedure, and then we grant access directly through that. So somebody runs the stored procedure, they don't go and run the base command. And this whole process is simplified by what's called the separation of duties framework. So let's have a look at how we would go and create a signed module. And then once we've had a look at the signed module, we'll look at how we can simplify that end-to-end process in order by using the separation of duties framework. So I'm going to come across into my script. So once again, I can go and create a login if I'm logged in as my help desk user. So we've seen that already. But what I want to do is I want to revoke that permission, the alter login. So we no longer have that for the particular help desk user. So I want to remove that. Okay. So what you'll see here is I'm going to configure the environment. So we've already got our database called dbAdmin here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and create a master key. So this master key is encrypted directly by a password here. I can use triple DES here as well, or I can also use AES encryption, depending on what the standards in my organization are. So what I'm then going to do is I'm going to then go and map my login, which I've done previously, and I've already created my schema, so happy days there. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to create my master key inside of that individual database. So let's go and do that to configure the environment. The next thing I'm going to do is I'm then going to go and create a server certificate. So that server certificate, the important thing about any certificate is I need to back that certificate up. There is no way to go and reverse this without brute force. And with AES 256, it's pretty hard to go and brute force that particular type of encryption algorithm. So the key thing is you'll see that I'm backing this locally up to ctemp. We obviously don't want to leave that on ctemp. We want to remove that away. So in SQL 2008, we can now start to go and store all of our encrypted keys on an encryption appliance, so we can centrally store all of those, but obviously get it off the server, because if somebody's got the key, they can then go and reverse that back. So once again, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move across into my dbAdmin database. I'm going to create a certificate inside of the DB admin database from that certificate that I've already got. Okay. So look, it's a bit of a long-winded process that we need to go, but these are the steps that we need to do in order to go and implement a sign module, because we're signing it by a certificate to in order to make sure that we can then validate that the thumbprint is correct, that it hasn't then been changed. So in order to actually ensure that that is consistent, we need to then compare that in our certificate. And that's why we go through that process, because all of a sudden our stored procedure or whatever it is that we're using has a thumbprint that we can then go and validate. So you'll see here I'm then going to go and create a login, and this login is going to be based on this certificate. So I'm then going to revoke connect on this particular this login that was created from this certificate, so this person can't actually go and log on to the machine at all. And I go and grant alter on that. Okay, so just execute that. Okay, great. Now, this is where all of the magic happens. Because what we want to be able to do is we want somebody to be able to go and run alter login. But in order for them to run alter login, what we're now going to get them to do is they're going to run a stored procedure called change password. So sysproc change password. So you can see that all the magic that happens in here is we're using the same command, but we're limiting it. So if I was to go and grant the alter login, we saw that we could do things that we didn't necessarily want that person to do. If we put them in member of sysadmin, obviously they can do everything. We put them in security admin, they can still do more than what it is that we want to do. So this allows us to then go and limit this particular user to do nothing else on that SQL Server instance apart from running this particular command, so the change password. They won't have select rights on anything. They won't be able to stop and start jobs. All they'll be able to do is run this particular stored procedure. So you'll see that I'm going to just go and create that. I typically go and create that in my DB admin database, so a secure database. I then go and grant execute on that particular stored procedure. And then I can then go and test the stored procedure. So let's go and log in, change my connection to help desk. Thank you. So I can then go and run that, go and change the password on that, happy days. So we've now implemented even finer granular security than what we get directly out of the box with SQL. So you guys are going to go now and do this to every stored procedure that you want somebody to do. So create, I want somebody to back up a database, I create a stored procedure for this. I want somebody to run SPWho2, I create a stored procedure for this. So do you think you guys are going to bespokely hand code all of that? Of course not. And that's where the separation of duties framework comes in. The separation of duties framework takes all of what we've just seen there and actually creates a process around that we can implement. So it really simplifies that. So we can very easily choose what it is that we want to do and then go and deploy that. So how does the separation of duties framework work? So basically we go and take these sign modules that we've created. We then go and implement them, so we create different tiers of access. So if you think about a sysadmin today inside of SQL Server, there is no differentiation. So at the moment, has anybody got different levels of DBAs, maybe operational DBAs, maybe development DBAs inside of the organisation? It's very hard to break up those and differentiate the different groups that are associated with them. Typically, we just put them all in sysadmin. But what we want to be able to do is we want to have like our tier 1 DBAs. Then we might have a concept of tier 2 DBAs. Now, tier 1 DBAs, you know, maybe they're the senior people inside of the organisation. When I say trust them, it's not from a financial, you know, they're not going to do something bad, but maybe they've got more experience with working with the environment, so I give them access to a larger number of commands. Where my tier 2 DBAs, I might just want to let them be process admins so that they can actually go and look at SPWho2, see what tasks are running, but I might want them to go and kill a task. So the problem is if I go and pop somebody in process admin today, they can run SPWho2 and see what's running, but they can also then go and issue the kill statement and terminate a process as well. So that's why I want to start to think about these different levels of DBAs that I have. So in order to set up the concept of the separation of duties, I need to go through defining the roles and tasks that each DBA inside of my organisation will perform. And this is where the hard work is, because this is an organisation by organisation specific thing, because there's no single DBA that's going to be different, the roles that they have across organisations, because it's also defined by regulatory compliance about what they can do and what they can't do as well. And this is what we've found with working with organisations, is trying to define what the roles and tasks that each DBA does is very unique across each organisation. But what we do is, once we've gone and defined them, we simply just go and create a folder structure. So the folder structure is, the top folder is the person that has the highest level of rights, and then we keep cascading that down to the lowest level of rights. So we would have tier 1 at the top, tier 2 beneath tier 1, tier 3 beneath tier 2. We then go and add a SQL script. So the SQL script is what does the create procedure. So as we saw, the create procedure for the alter login. We then go and have a PowerShell script, and this is where the magic happens with this, is the PowerShell script then goes and applies this across our SQL instance, and then we go and map users and groups directly to that. So what we're going to have a look at now is, I've got a vanilla SQL Server 2008 R2 with SP1 installed on my machine here. I'm going to walk you through end-to-end implementing what we just saw there around signed security modules using the separation of duties framework. Now, as I said before, the separation of duties framework is available as a free download from CodePlex, so you can go and take this and go back to your workplaces and implement it over the weekend. There's beer to be drunk tonight, come on. So what you'll see here, that in my root directory here, I've got my SOD 2.0, so it's version 2 of the framework, and this is the zip file that you get when you go and download the framework from CodePlex. So what I'm going to do is, I'm just going to extract this here just to show you that everything we're doing is actually from first principles, that there's no MasterChef, here's one we prepared earlier style of approach going on. So let's extract that, okay. So in here, you'll see that we've got a number of folders. We've obviously got our documentation, but look, as DBAs, we don't need documentation. We've then got this install folder, and we've also got our sample administration procedures. So these are some of the common things that you want to enable a DBA to do. So maybe kill a process, start a job, update statistics, back up a database. So what I've decided is that my restricted people, they're able to go and use alter login, and I'm also going to want them to be able to start jobs. So this might be my NOC team or my operations team that works 24/7. A job fails in the middle of the night. I want them maybe to be able to restart that job if it's failed. So what I do is, I go and copy that. And what I do is, I go back into my SOD, into my install folder in procedures. Now, this is where we need to then go and add in that hierarchical structure. So to simplify it, I'm just going to create one level of hierarchy called restricted. Pop those two stored procs directly in there. So what's going to happen is, we're going to do all of the user mappings, create all the certificates, all the signed modules that we showed before, automatically using this process. So I'm going to open up SQL Server here. Inside of SQL Server, I'm then going to launch PowerShell. So start PowerShell. So you'll see directly in my folder, inside of my install folder, what you'll see that I've got a PowerShell install script. So what this install script is going to do is, it's going to create my roles. It's going to do all of the administration set up directly for me. So let's go back inside of PowerShell here. So what I'm going to do here in PowerShell is, I'm going to set my location. So I just go set location for where my install PowerShell script is. So set location to be /sod/install. And then, because I'm lazy and not going to be able to type this successfully, I'm just going to drag and drop that directly across. So I'm now going to execute this PowerShell script that I've got here. So what this PowerShell script is going to do is prompt me for where I'm going to apply my SOD framework. So you'll see here localhost. Okay. So the database name for my management database, so dbAdmin. Now, where am I going to store my certificate information? So in this case, ctemp. And then I need to give it some passwords. So this is the same process that we went through bespokely using TSQL, but now we've got a nice, seamless, automated process to do this for us. So I'm now going to go and log give it the password, so ABC123. And you'll see for each of the different certificates that I'm creating and keys that I'm creating, it's prompting me. Okay. So what's happened now is it's gone and you executed this PowerShell script. It's gone and created my DB admin database. And if I go now back into Management Studio and do a refresh, see, there's my DB admin database. You'll see that under programmability, you'll see that there's my two stored procedures that have been created. I come into security and I've got my login that's been created. So you'll see my login for that certificate. And what I'm now going to do is I'm now going to go and create a new help desk login. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to map them. And you'll see that when I go into DB admin, you'll see that now there's that restricted role. That restricted role came off that folder structure that I then created. So by adding our help desk user now into that restricted role, what have I done here? From SQL authentication. Thank you very much, kind sir. Great. Okay, so now what we've done is map that. That help desk user, the only thing that it's going to have access to on this SQL instance is the ability to then go and execute those stored procedures. Those stored procedures starting a job typically would need rights to SP start job directly inside of the MSDB database. I don't have that anymore. All I've got access to is ability to execute those stored procedures that then go and use my credentials. So if I go and run SQL Server Profiler, I'll see that it's the help desk user. It's not mapping to a different execution context at all. So we've got then full transparency from an auditability point of view across the board there. So look, one of the things we've actually added directly onto the separation of duties framework is the ability to automate that even to a more granular level as well. So what we can do here is we can go and actually run what's called our SOD framework tool. And what this allows us to do is it allows us to then go and connect to a SQL instance. So we can connect to our local host. Once I've gone and connect to my local host, I then get a list of all of the system procedures and functions that a DBA may need. So everything from adding an article to a replication publication or subscription, all the way through to adding a login and everything in between. And you'll see that what we're doing here is we're actually generating the code that's then needed in order to be used inside of the SOD framework. So you'll see that we've got a number of wildcards that we use in there that the PowerShell script then goes and uses to inject. So where we typed in dbAdmin, for example, as the database, it can then go and use that. So this is now something that you can then, once you've done that mapping about what are the roles and responsibilities and individual tasks that a DBA needs, we can then go and pick and choose what they are, feed those directly into the SOD framework, and then execute it. Question? Well, these are system stored procedures. So typically we use SOD to actually grant privileges to a system stored PROC. So if a system stored PROC actually changes the context because of a service pack update or something like that, then you don't need to go and rechange it unless, for example, a new parameter is added in that you want to then go and take advantage of. But that's a really good question, because the question was, is do I need to then think about refreshing? Because this is a framework that we've really shown how it can be used for doing system commands. So, for example, backing up databases, adding logins, but it's also something that you could go and use to execute a standard stored procedure as well. So it doesn't necessarily have to be used around the system space. So what we've shown you in the last hour and 5 minutes so far is we've gone and shown you what we can do inside of the SOD framework. We've really shown you that you've got all of the tools that you need today in order to go and keep the DBA out of the database. Now, you might be looking at yourself and going, well, that looks like a fairly complex process in order to do. And really it is. Security is one of the most complicated areas of any ecosystem, whether that's SQL Server or any of the other products that we need to deal with. But what this allows us to do is to actually, when we have scenarios where we do need to have full transparency from an auditability point of view, where we need to go and meet various different regulatory requirements, we have a framework and process in place that allows us to then go and easily manage that. And that's what's called the separation of duties framework. So you see that we've got two resource links there. So the first is actually the separation of duties framework and also the SOD utility that we demonstrated very quickly as well. That's a free download that we've made available. We're going to promote that also into CodePlex, into the SOD library as well. So we can then easily do everything that we've shown in this particular demo. So folks, that really brings us to where we wanted to get to in this afternoon's presentation. I know I'm about all that's between you and the opportunity to go and have another beer. So once again, I thank you very much for your time today in the session. I hope you got something out of it. And look, as I said, we are going to do something special because there was supposed to be a promise of me bringing beer. So what we decided to do is we've actually got some great mugs floating around for you guys. So if you simply just drop me an email, I will then actually go and send you a free mug out to you. So make sure you just go and drop us an email and we'll organise to get a mug out to you, seeing that we didn't have any beer for you. So folks, I'm going to open up the floor to questions because I understand that what we've looked at is probably a really complex topic in a lot of ways and allow you to actually then drill into that a little bit deeper. So once again, guys, thank you very much. Don't forget to fill your eval forms out before you head to the Locknote. Thanks, guys.